Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Here on the Cape and Islands, we might take it for granted that older residents are active in their communities, on public lands, and in natural spaces. But in 1989, a group of senior women in Utah took umbrage when their senator used the, quote, aged and infirm to reject calls for creating a new wilderness area. They responded by forming a conservation group of, by, and for older women. They call it Great Old Broads for Wilderness. Executive Director Shelley Silbert recently visited Martha's Vineyard to talk about climate change and the issues that connect public lands in the American Southwest with life here in the Northeast. Shelley Silbert, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you, Heather. It's good to be here.
All right. Great Old Broads for Wilderness. I love the name. Where did the idea for this organization come from?
Well, many people are surprised to know that we've actually been around for 26 years now. And we were formed when a group of five women were hiking in Utah in the Escalante, now a national monument. And they were wanting to do work to advocate for more wilderness areas. And when they got out of their hike, they heard that Senator Orrin Hatch had made a comment that wilderness was of no value to the elderly and the disabled because they couldn't access it. And these five women decided that he was not going to speak in their name and that they wanted to have an organization that would speak for older people and say that whether they could access it or not, they wanted to have wilderness out there and they felt that lands should be protected. So they basically started the organization as a counter to this comment, which I bet Senator Hatch wouldn't be too happy to know about. But they wanted to have an organization that was looking at these issues with the spirit of camaraderie and fun and humor.
I would say humor, obviously, a part of it.
Obviously, you get that immediately with our name. It's a name that's pretty memorable. And they wanted to be sure that they were doing work as activists, as advocates for wild public lands, but that they were also doing work together in developing women's leadership and just enjoying each other's company, particularly as older women, always inclusive of men and inclusive of younger people of both genders, of all genders. But basically, they wanted to show that they were out there with a spirit of fun, a little bit sassy, a little bit feisty, but always working to protect wild lands and wild habitat.
What do you think that older women in particular, I mean, there are plenty of moms for and moms against groups, advocacy groups, but what do older women in particular bring to the issue of conservation and environmental advocacy?
Well, older women bring years of experience to this work. They have been out hiking, learning, teaching their children, if they have children, their grandchildren, basically out working professionally, doing all kinds of different work over their lifetime. And people forget that as elders, you know, our society today doesn't respect elders quite in the way that I think society is used to. And they forget that elders really have a lot to bring to the table. One of the things that I think is critically important is the memory of what lands looked like, what waters looked like. So maybe 50, 60, 70 years ago, of course, things were quite different, but the very specific things that they might remember, which plants were here, what was the diversity of species, how many fish were being caught of certain types, what were they looking at, and how have things changed over time? What about the fire regime? What about, you know, just the storm patterns? All of these things people have memories of, and not that those memories are always scientifically accurate, but they do provide a certain type of knowledge, a certain type of background that we can then work from and say, how have things changed and why? So that's one of the things that older women bring. I think the other thing that they bring so importantly is a passion and a commitment because of those years of involvement and that history of how things have changed in the society as well as on the landscape. So I think that type of that memory is so important to younger people today to be able to recognize that, you know, we have this baseline of what we're seeing today, but things were not always that way. So older women, older people bring that kind of history and knowledge and can speak from a place of a real sense of place about the landscape.
As you said, one of the things that started the group was the desire to make sure that there were wilderness areas formally designated and accessible. But another thing that you guys work on is something called orphan lands. What are orphan lands?
Orphan lands are those lands that are kind of left behind and not necessarily thought of in terms of they are public lands, but they're not being protected. So we think of our national forests and our national parks and our Bureau of Land Management lands, probably not something that many people are thinking about here in the East, but in the West, there are a lot of lands that are under the management of Bureau of Land Management, one of our federal agencies. We think of these lands as lands that are protected. However, this is actually where there's a tremendous amount of commercial activity taking place, things like mining for coal, for oil and gas, road development, other kinds of activities that we don't necessarily think about on our public lands. So it's a way to think about those lands that aren't truly protected in the way that most Americans probably think they are.
I mean, I think it's interesting to realize just how different from region to region within our country some of these issues are. I mean, wilderness areas, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of those in the Northeast at this point. We don't have those same issues of grazing or uses of public lands the same way that they exist in the Southwest, where this group really got started.
Right. We got started in the Southwest, and we're currently based in Durango, Colorado. I think we always will be, but we are a national organization. So we have chapters all across the country looking at the specific issues at the local level. Now, most of our chapters currently are in the West, but we do have a chapter in Minnesota, a group starting in Georgia, a group starting in Maine. We're always interested in starting new chapters. And the way we do our work is that those local, primarily women, are involved in looking at what their specific issues are around public lands or around climate change, which has become a real focus of our attention in the last few years, and deciding, you know, what are they passionate about? What would they like to work on protecting? For example, here in the East, you know, it would be quite possible for a group to work on the Seamounts and Coastal Marine Reserve National Monument that is being proposed. So, you know, a group could say, we'd really like to work on marine issues, and that would be the focus of our chapter. That's how we would like to do our work, and that then they would put their focus there. Or it could be that they decide they really want to work on climate change issues, climate change education, efforts to keep oil and gas and coal in the ground, because to make these decisions at the national level, we need people from all over the country.
What is the connection in your mind between climate change advocacy, which I think often we think climate policy, we think power plants or, you know, international agreements. It seems much more amorphous as opposed to this very concrete idea of land preservation. How do you see those two being connected?
Mm-hmm. Well, really, there are two ways that climate and public lands interact that we are looking at. And because we are a public lands organization, that is the frame from which we are currently looking at climate change. First of all, there's a tremendous impact of climate change on our public lands. And you can see that, you know, of course, in the East on national seashore areas, on national parks, you know, areas that are being affected by surges and storms, by sea level rise, those kinds of things. In the West, we're seeing it more in the way of forest fires that are uncontrollable, much larger than they ever were in the past, and much more severe in their intensity. We're also seeing, of course, the scourge of beetles, of bark beetles and spruce beetles that are coming across. They're not getting killed in extreme winter temperatures. They need negative 60 degree temperatures for a couple of weeks at night to be killed. And so that's not happening anymore. And so we're seeing these beetles basically taking out massive numbers of trees in national forests. We're seeing, of course, more severe storms and flooding because, of course, as the temperatures warm up, what happens is there's more ability for the air to hold moisture, and then that comes down in more extreme rainfall, more extreme snowfall, and just these erratic weather patterns that we're beginning to see. So all of those have a great impact on our public lands, and that's we want to protect our public lands as well as our communities from all of these kinds of climate effects. But we're also seeing something that we really probably don't think about either in the West or in the East. And that is, you know, when we think about national forests and national parks and Bureau of Land Management lands, or these areas that are wilderness or even unprotected wild areas, we think, okay, that's great because they're absorbing a lot of that excess carbon that's now in the atmosphere, much like the ocean absorbs carbon. But these areas should be very important, like the rainforest, right? Instead, we're mining in these areas. We're taking out coal. We're taking out oil and gas. And if you look overall at what's happening on our public lands, we're actually emitting 4.5 times the amount of carbon from our public lands than we are sequestering. And that is what the Center for American Progress calls a clogged carbon sink. We should be sequestering, and instead we're emitting. Many people don't realize that a quarter of the greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. are coming from, are originating from our public lands, those lands that were put in trust for Americans, for all Americans, and for our future, are actually producing 25% of our greenhouse gases.
They're coming from those mining and extraction activities directly?
That's right. That's right. So when they're burned, you know, the origination point is from those public lands. And what's important about that is that because they are public lands, federal lands, we are able to have a say in how they're managed. And as citizens, we have the responsibility and the right to be commenting, to be influencing, to have a say in what happens on our public lands. So if we feel that this is not appropriate to have a quarter of all our greenhouse gas emissions coming from our national public lands, then we have the opportunity to come in and say, you know, this isn't the way we'd like to see these managed. And that's where a group like Great Old Broads for Wilderness comes in, because we're able to get out there and be advocates and activists. We are right now advocating to keep to not have any new leases of our public lands for these activities. So basically right now there's quite a lot of these public lands that have been leased for fossil fuel activities, oil, gas, coal in particular, but also oil shale, tar sands are coming about now, some of the dirtiest fuels that could be taken from our public lands. And we have the opportunity to say, you know, this is not how the lands that are there for the national interest should be used, because in fact, they're working quite the opposite way. We are soon going to be, and we already are paying for the effects of climate change on our communities. We're paying for the effects on our public lands. So we want to say no new leases of oil and gas should be taking place on public lands until we have evaluated the full scale of climate impacts and the social costs of carbon. Right now, the Department of the Interior has a moratorium on coal leasing, which we think is a very good thing, because 40% of our coal in this country does come from our public lands. The moratorium is to evaluate whether the public is really getting the benefit that they should be getting from this mining of coal on public lands. Are they charging enough for the leases? Are they getting enough royalties from the fossil fuel companies? What are we getting back? But we're saying they also need to be looking very carefully at the social costs of carbon. What is the impact on all of society, on our cities, on our rural communities of mining this coal? And that's something that the Department of the Interior has determined needs to be reevaluated. We believe that that's a very important step. We want it to look at social costs of carbon, but we also believe that that same thing needs to be done for natural gas and for oil that is being increasingly extracted from our public lands through new fracking technologies and and horizontal drilling.
You've been on Martha's Vineyard both exploring issues of women's leadership and speaking to people about these issues of climate change and public lands. And I wonder what kinds of connections come out of that conversation coming from Colorado to Martha's Vineyard. You know, are there a lot of people going, oh, well, this is really Colorado's issue? This is really somebody else's issue? Or, you know, we're kind of on the receiving end of, mm-hmm. of that extraction, that we don't have fracking going on in Massachusetts. We don't have a lot of extraction going on in Massachusetts. So what are the conversations like and the connections that come out of that?
Yeah, part of my reason for wanting to come out here, and I was really thrilled to have the opportunity to speak at the Sargent Gallery in Martha's Vineyard in Aquinnah, was formerly known as the Gay Head Gallery. And I was really thrilled to have the opportunity to speak to over 60 people there on Sunday night to talk about those very connections, because too often we don't think about these things. And what I saw was people are very concerned about climate change. They're seeing impacts. They're recognizing that the system that we're operating under right now is not working and it needs a fix. And they're recognizing that the majority of the American people also want to see this changed. I mean, when you're living on an island, you're one of the first places to begin to see the effects of climate change, whether through these, you know, storm surges, through sea level rise, through more erratic snowfall patterns, all of these things that I've mentioned earlier. So anyone on an island is seeing those, as we are seeing them out west as well. But most people were not aware of this connection between where our fossil fuels are being taken out of the ground in the United States and where they're feeling the impacts here. So I think there is a real importance in our beginning to connect the dots and beginning to see that we all as citizens have to have a role in working on climate change. A Gallup poll that came out in March had the highest numbers of people ever recognizing that climate change is either a serious concern for them or a big concern. So it was 65%, and then 64% of those recognized that global warming or climate change is being caused by humans. So I think there was a period of time where Americans were kind of we're beginning to think climate change was not real. But I think with the scientific evidence that's come out and the effects that people are seeing, I think that concern level again is rising. And, you know, I think about there was recently something that came out on Facebook I thought was pretty funny, where it says only in America do people rely on a rodent, Punxsutawney Phil in Pennsylvania, to predict the weather, but deny the evidence from climate scientists that climate change is real. So this is something that we need to be paying a lot of attention to, and those connections have to be made about, you know, whether you're dealing with fracking in your community, whether you're dealing with a coal mine or not, you're still going to be seeing the impacts of climate change. So we have to think nationally in terms of our national public lands, and of course we have to think globally in terms of, you know, the summits and the treaties and the efforts that are being made at the global scale to reduce climate change, because we are all in this together, reduce the greenhouse gas emissions.
Shelley Silbert is the executive director of Great Old Broads for Wilderness. Shelley, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Heather. It's been a pleasure.
Shelley mentioned efforts to establish a marine national monument in New England waters. Well, last week, advocates for that proposal released a new poll showing that the majority of Massachusetts residents support the plan. Commercial fishing groups reject the poll, calling it misleading. You can read or listen to that story on our website, capeandislands.org. You can also find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.